Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Joseph Fink, the President Emeritus of Dominican University in Marin County, California. I'm also the past Chairman of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and tonight, your moderator. You'll find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or download the club's iPhone and Android app for schedule information and to register for programs. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Robert Reich, former United States Secretary of Labor under President Bill Clinton and the Chancellor's Professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. Time magazine named Robert Reich one of the most 10 effective cabinet secretaries in the 20th century. He has written 13 books, including the bestsellers Aftershock, The Work of Nations, which is available in 23 languages, if I remember correctly, and Beyond Outrage. He is also the founding editor of the American Prospect magazine and chairman of Common Cause. Professor Reich is featured in the new film documentary, Inequality for All, which is based upon his newly updated book, Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. He appears regularly on television to comment on politics and economics. At Berkeley, he teaches public policy. He's been a public servant in three different administrations, a cabinet secretary, a professor, an author, and now, because he is featured and starring in the film Equality of All, he's making Brad Pitt very nervous. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Robert Reich.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Well, thank you. Good evening, San Francisco. And Joseph, thank you very much for that introduction. Brad Pitt has absolutely nothing to worry about. Let me assure you. Because I am rather conspicuous in terms of my size and I appear on television and so forth, I'm often asked questions by complete strangers as if we were in an ongoing conversation. It happened again a couple of days ago. I was in an airport, and somebody came up to me and said, I had never seen this person before. I want you to know this is a kind of a disembodied, strange feeling. They came up and they said, so where's it going? there's a moment at which, I kind of wonder, do I know this person? And what's the it? But a moment's reflection, gave me an insight into what he was talking about, and that had to do with the fact that the Dow Jones Industrial Average that day had broken through 16,000. And so he was saying, where's it going? As if he's an old friend I never saw him before in my life, but he wanted to know what many of us want to know. Well, where is the stock market going? And what's going on with this economy? I mean, that something very strange is happening. It has happened before, but it is happening in a way now that looks remarkably weird, odd. The stock market is doing very well. It's breaking records. The Standard & Poor's 500, the Dow, most of your indices. But at the same time, the real economy, that is the economy in which most people live and work, is not doing all that well. This is the most anemic recovery on record. And if you consider how far down we came in the Great Recession, It's even more troubling because usually the further the economy sinks, the faster it comes up after a decline to get back on track. I mean, after the Great Depression hit bottom in 1933, the following years were very, very good. There was a lot of growth. In 1934, about 4.5%. 1935, about 8%. 1936, about 12%. Now, something happened in 1937. If we have time, we'll get back to that. But my point is that this economy is remarkably underwhelming. It's underfunctioning. You also have large numbers of Americans still out of work. Fewer people are employed today than before the Great Recession. The number of people who are adults capable of working, willing to work, able to work, who are not working is extraordinarily high. The labor participation rate, technically, that is the percentage of people who are of working age who are in the labor force versus not in the labor force, is really at its lowest level since 1979. And 1978, 1979, those are the years that women, many of them, went into paid work, wives and mothers, in large numbers. Wives and mothers went into paid work. Poor women, by the way, had always been in paid work. Wives and mothers said, oh, it worked, but it just wasn't paid. But starting in the late 1970s, women went into paid work in large numbers. We have not seen a labor participation ratio this low since before women actually headed into work in such large numbers, because it was the 1980s where you really had the big influx. So what is going on? How can the stock market be doing so wonderfully well and the real economy be doing so poorly? I should add, if you're not already giddy from the good news I've given you in terms of the real economy, median household incomes, that is the typical household, that typical household adjusted for inflation is seeing their incomes drop. Now, I said median, and it's important that you, if anytime somebody says median or somebody says average, you know the difference. In fact, when anybody tells you that average wages are rising or average people are doing well, watch your wallets. The basketball player Shaquille O'Neal and I have an average height of 6'1". Do you get my drift? You see, people at the top bring up the average, and so it's much more meaningful to look at the median. That is, the person smack in the middle, equal number above, equal number below. Median households, even with two wage earners, median household income dropping, adjusted for inflation. So how do we explain this dissonance? Well, one thing that's going on is that corporate profits are up. Partly, some would say largely, because they are cutting their payrolls and continue to do so. They started this in the Great Recession, but there has been not much of a let-up. They're cutting their payrolls, many companies, not only by hiring fewer people or by cutting back on the numbers of people, substituting technology, outsourcing, or reducing wages or keeping wages level without any inflation adjustment or reducing benefits. However it is being done, to squeeze down the costs, since labor costs tend to be about 70% of the total cost of a business, and that's understandable. I'm not blaming businesses for trying to make money, particularly in difficult times when there's not that much purchasing power in the middle class or the poor. Another point I'll come back to in a moment. I'm putting out for your benefit a bunch of data points here. Then we'll connect the points up in just a moment. But I just want you to plant these flags so you have sort of the pattern, and a pattern begins to emerge for you. So we've got median families going down because, in part, companies are shrinking their payrolls. And that shrinking of payrolls is maintaining profits, even though sales are not doing all that wonderfully well for many companies. What else is going on? Well, another thing that's happening is that companies are using their cash And companies, big companies, are still sitting on about $1.6 trillion of cash. That's a lot of money to sit on. They're using their cash, many companies, to buy back their shares of stock. Now, buying back your share of stock, again, perfectly legal. I'm not blaming any company for doing this. It does show a striking lack of imagination. If that's the way you boost your stock price, and if that's the main way you have of boosting your stock price, by simply buying back your shares of stock, well, again, perfectly legal, you can do it, but it's not as if it's generating much innovation or much new job or much by way of social benefit or even sustainable. You can't just keep on purchasing your share. I suppose you could theoretically until you've got, you know, one shareholder left who's very, very wealthy because that share of stock has been boosted a lot by all of the buying the company is doing. But again, it's not a terribly sustainable or a terribly imaginative way of boosting your stock price. There's a third thing going on, and maybe it is the major thing. And it has to do with this institution called the Federal Reserve Board. Janet Yellen, who many of us know personally, she is an absolute wonderful person. She will make a fabulous chair of the Federal Reserve Board. She's here. She was here at the Stanford, at the San Francisco. I almost said Stanford. Shame on me. She's from Berkeley. The San Francisco Federal Reserve Board. And she was one of my colleagues at Berkeley, and I have enormous confidence in her. What she has said, and she said in her in the hearings on her nomination, and she has said over and over again, not all that differently from Ben Bernanke. I mean, the two of them are pretty close together on this. She was the vice chair before. In fact, she technically still is the vice chair. And what she and Ben Bernanke both have been talking about and doing is engaging in a process of buying securities. And by buying securities, keeping interest rates low. This has taken a couple of different forms. Ben Bernanke has called it quantitative easing. Other people have called it different things. Sometimes it has to do with long-term bonds. Sometimes it has to do with short-term bonds. Right now it's mostly short-term. We don't need to get into the details. I can see your eyes are already glazing over. But the point is, here's the point. When the Fed keeps interest rates very, very low, as it has been doing, then everybody who has any savings at all tends to look at the bond market and say, well, I don't think I'm going to put my savings into bonds because I can't really get very much interest out of there. I think, well, where shall I go? There's not many alternatives. There is equity, that is the stock market. And so by keeping interest rates low, what the Fed has been doing is basically pumping a lot of money that might otherwise go into bonds into the stock market. And when you pump money into the stock market, that also tends to raise stock prices. Not incidentally, those low interest rates have made it easier for companies to borrow because big companies are low credit risks, so they can borrow at very low rates. And some of that borrowed money can be used to buy back their shares of stock. So you see how beautiful the system becomes. It's a work of art. It's an aesthetic marvel in terms of keeping the stock market buoyant and keeping it going very, very, very well. But it does depend on a couple of things continuing. Not only the ability to keep payrolls down and continuing to cut real payrolls, also the ability to continue to buy back shares of stock if that's what companies are doing, but also the Fed continuing to buy about $85 billion a month of long-term and short-term securities. That's a hard thing to do. I mean, eventually people start worrying. Don't we have to worry about inflation? I mean, don't we have to worry about when this ends? I mean, it has to end eventually, doesn't it? Doesn't it, folks? Yes. Class? Yes, it has to end eventually, and then when it starts ending, in fact, there was a little flurry. Did you notice today, any of you Fed watchers, you know what happened today? There was a little flurry of worry, a little worry flurry, because the notes of the October meeting of the Federal Reserve came out, and the Fed governors were actually talking about ending this buying program, this buying of securities, which would, well, that would cause interest rates to rise. In fact, interest rates just merely on the publication, of the notes of the meeting, yields, treasury yields started to rise. And the stock market, you know, people got nervous. Can you imagine what will happen when the Fed actually announces it's no longer going to continue to buy all those securities and it's going to allow interest rates to rise? Now, I don't want to alarm anybody here. I can tell, you know, 5 minutes ago your eyes were glazed. Now you look panicked, all of you. Don't do that. Don't worry. I'm not here to make you worry. I just want to illustrate to you something that's going on that can't go on forever. Most things can't go up. Nothing can go on forever. We can't go on forever. But this can't go on forever either. When you have this dissonance, this gap between the financial economy and the real economy, something has got to give, and what usually gives is the financial economy. Because the financial economy is, to use a word advisedly, derivative of the real economy. Now, that brings us back to a debate that's going on in Washington these days. A debate has been going on actually for longer than anybody even wants to remember, between two different schools of economic thought in terms of fiscal policy. Now, a moment ago I was talking about monetary policy and the Fed. And I might, just to segue into fiscal policy, let you have my thinking about the relationship between the two, and that is that the Fed probably should continue, as long as unemployment is high, continue to keep interest rates low, but the problem is if fiscal policy, that is spending and taxing, that's what Congress and the President do, if fiscal policy is not expansionary at the same time, if you've got an expansionary Fed with monetary policy that is very stimulative, but you have austerity prevailing with regard to fiscal policy, regard to what the spending and taxing functions of government do, then you have essentially a Fed that is handicapped dramatically. What we're doing is asking the Fed single-handedly to support the economic expansion. And the Fed simply can't do that. The Fed can't do it alone. The Fed trying to do it alone is like pushing on spaghetti. It doesn't really, I mean, the spaghetti may move a little bit when you push on it, but if it's a wet noodle, it doesn't move all that much. These are complicated economic terms. So with regard to fiscal policy, why are we locked into this austerity economics? Well, we're locked into austerity economics because of politics. Politics. Politics comes from that Greek root poly, meaning many, and ticks, small blood-sucking insects. No, I don't really mean that, as a matter of fact. I have enormous respect for politicians, and I spent a number of years of my life in Washington. Although when I go back there, it's like going into a war zone. I mean, it's just awful. It was never like this before. I don't know why. Can I have a parenthetical with you, just a personal note, if I may? Look, I have lived through, many of you are old enough to remember, times in our nation's history when we were really sharply divided over real issues. Do you remember, anybody here remember the communist witch hunts of the 1950s? I'm not going to ask you to identify yourself. You don't want to give away your age. But that was divisive. And then we had the civil rights movement, and that was really divisive and hard for parts of this country, many of us. And some of us were involved in that. Some of us lost some friends in that. And then we had the Vietnam War. I mean, talk about divisiveness. I graduated in 1968, and I remember the commencement speaker at my graduation urged my classmates to leave America, join him, and go to Canada rather than be drafted, which prompted, as I looked around, at least 12 pairs of parents getting into fistfights. Now, that was divisiveness. Those were hard times. Our cities were burning down in 1967. Martin Luther King, 1968, was assassinated. Bobby Kennedy assassinated. Talk about divisiveness. But now there is a greater degree of anger and bile in America than I ever remember. And I go to Washington and Republicans and Democrats won't talk to each other. And I look back on all of these other eras when, despite the divisiveness, we at least talked to each other, we tried to work together, and I wonder what is going on now. I can't even, are people not talking to each other because they have different views of fiscal policy? Is that what's going on? Maybe we'll have time to come back to that too. You see, it's all related. Everything is related I'm talking about here. So you've got these two schools, these two economic schools of policy. One is basically austerity. It says the debt is the worst thing that we can possibly have. We've got to get rid of the debt, the deficit, which is the yearly deficit that becomes a cumulative debt. And then the other side that says, no, we need more spending, more stimulus now. Maybe we can worry about the debt once the economy gets going, but we ought to do something in the interim to stimulate the economy. And you have essentially that battle, and that's been going on for a while. It's preoccupied Washington, the entire Obama administration. It preoccupied most of Washington during the Clinton administration when I was there. It's become a battle where there is no compromise at all. Those people who think that the biggest problem right now is debt, well, they just don't know what they're talking about, if I may be politely, say it politely. The debt... I didn't expect an applause on that line. I mean, because the deficit, the yearly deficit, is coming down as a proportion of the GDP, the total economy. And what you really want to look at is the debt as a proportion of the total economy. That's the only meaningful measure. An absolute number means nothing. You want to look at the debt as a proportion of the national economy. It's quite large now, but it's not as large as it was after the Second World War. It was 120% of the national economy. In fact, I remember as a kid, when I was about 5 or 6 years old, my father, who did not like Franklin D. Roosevelt, he warned me, he said, Bobby, you and your children and your children's children will be paying down the debt created by Franklin D. Roosevelt. Now, I was 5. I didn't know what a debt was, but I had nightmares about it. I thought of myself and my children and my children's children. But the fact of the matter is, by the late 50s, in fact, even by the mid-1950s, nobody was talking about Franklin D. Roosevelt's debt. And my children, I have two boys, they're now 28 and 32, not once in their entire lifetimes have they mentioned Franklin D. Roosevelt's debt. I have a 5-year-old granddaughter. She was very articulate, very precocious, she is really remarkable and very, very bright. And not once over the 5 years, she's talked about everything except Franklin D. Roosevelt's debt. So what happened to FDR's debt? Well, what happened to that debt was that the ratio of the debt to the GDP changed. Not because we spent that much less. Yes, we did go from World War II to a non-war, but we went right into the Cold War. We had a Korean War. We rebuilt Japan. We rebuilt Europe. We had the National Highway Building Program. We had the GI Bill. It wasn't as if we were skimping. The real reason that the debt-GDP ratio changed was because the economy grew so rapidly in the 1950s. You see, the problem we are having now with regard to our debt is that we're growing so slowly. We're almost, by some measures, we're growing, 2% annualized per year? I mean, this again, as I said to you before, it is remarkable on its own. It's even more troubling given how far down the economy has been. That's the problem. That's the problem. And for some of you, I know that some of you may be saying, well, growth is not necessarily good. Bear with me on this. Because I'm not saying that growth in terms of utilizing and using up natural resources is all that good, but growing our capacity to do all sorts of things, including sustainable environmental protection and better energy sources and more health care and better education, our capacity to do all of these things is what's really at issue. That's what is not growing, and that's what is disturbing. Now, I am a proud Keynesian. I expected applause on that line, but... and Keynesianism was all in fashion in the 1950s, 60s, and early 70s. I mean, Richard Nixon said, and I'm not quoting him because his quote was more complicated than this, but it was recorded like everything else he said. He said, we're all Keynesians now. We're all Keynesians now. Now, Keynesianism got a very bad rap in the late 1970s when, as some of you remember, we had double-digit inflation and Paul Volcker took over the Fed and broke the back of inflation by basically breaking the back of the economy and sending Jimmy Carter home to Georgia at the same time. But at that moment, really from that time on, from the late 70s, with double-digit inflation, instead of worrying mostly about inadequate demand, we started worrying mostly about too much demand and inflation. But let me suggest something to you. We are now back to a time, and we've been back to a time without really recognizing it, where the central economic challenge is not inflation. The central economic challenge is inadequate demand. Inadequate demand. We are not growing because the American middle class and the poor do not have the purchasing power to keep the economy going. Why not? And here I come to what I think is the crux of the issue. It's not simply Keynesianism versus economic austerity. What's a good word for the austeritarians? Austerics. Well, it's not simply the debate between the Keynesians and the austerics. It is much more profound. It is about inequality. Because we have seen for the last 30 years that increasingly the economic gains from growth have gone to a smaller and smaller number of people. We've seen increasingly over the last 30 years that the middle class has been under greater and greater stress. There has been less upward mobility. Fewer poor people are joining the middle class. Even since the recovery began in 2009, we now know, one of my colleagues at Berkeley, Emmanuel Saez, has done pioneering work measuring what has happened to the economy and where the economic gains have gone. And he has shown that since the recovery began in 2009, roughly 95% of the economic gains have gone to the top 1%. Now, how do you run an economy in which 95% of the economic gains go to the top 1%. I'm not blaming anybody, certainly not blaming the top 1%, but the problem when you have so much income and wealth concentrated in so few hands is that there's no way, in Keynesian terms, there's no way that that relatively few number of people at the top can possibly spend all that much. I mean, think of the difficulty. I mean, let's just say, just for the sake of the argument, that you are a chief executive or a hedge fund manager or a private equity manager, or maybe you're an entertainer, maybe you are a star, maybe you are, a technology mogul, maybe whoever, whatever the reason, but you're making, let's say, for the sake of the argument, $10, $15 million a year, $20 million a year. Think of how hard you would have to work. to spend that. I mean, it would take 24 hours a day, every day. You couldn't even go to work. You would have to... I mean, that's why the savings in the country are coming primarily from the top. The top 10%, the richest 10% of us, I gather, I would be surprised if anybody in this room was not in the top, at least top 10%. Top 10% owns 80% of the shares of stock in the United States. What's the major asset that the bottom 90% have, if they have any assets at all? Their homes. Now, home values are going up a little bit, but not everywhere. And certainly they haven't made up for where they were before, and yet the stock market has done wonderfully, wonderfully well. Do you get my drift? Inequality, yes. Thank you. Inequality is not something that is just unfair. It is not just a moral blight. It's not just a scourge. We could be talking about it in many different terms, in kind of philosophical terms, in terms of moral philosophy. You know, economics, by the way, began with Alfred Marshall's great Principles of Economics, published in 1890. Before then, in the 19th century, it was all political economy. That is, you couldn't really separate politics and economics. And in the 18th century, it was something different entirely. It wasn't even political economy. Adam Smith called himself a moral philosopher. Moral philosophy. It was all about what is a good society. My point is that you don't even have to go into moral philosophy to understand that the kind of inequality we are now experiencing, when the 400 richest Americans have more wealth than the bottom 150 million Americans put together, you don't have to get into moral philosophy to see that this is undermining our economy overall. The rich would do better with a smaller share of a rapidly growing economy, rapidly growing because more people can participate in it, than they're doing now with a large share of an economy that's basically dead in the water. We also know that democracy suffers when we have extraordinary degrees of inequality. Political power follows the money. We also know that there is divisiveness. I mentioned before how divided Washington is, how angry people are. Well, I want to suggest to you something that political scientists looking at divisiveness and political anger and polarization noticed years ago, and they've been following it very carefully, they've been tracking it. It correlates almost exactly with the degree of inequality in society. The more inequality, the more polarization. Why is that? There are many theories, but I think the easiest and most straightforward is that when most people are working harder and harder and not getting ahead, they get frustrated, they get scared, they get angry, particularly when they feel like the game is loaded, the dice are loaded, the deck is stacked against them. And when they are that angry and frustrated and nervous and worried about their future and they're working as hard as they possibly can, they are very vulnerable to demagogues on the right or the left who point the finger of blame at some set of scapegoats. Maybe they're immigrants. Maybe they're the poor. Maybe they're the rich. Maybe they are corporations. Maybe they're unions. Maybe there's government. There are as many scapegoats as you want. But when we get into a politics of scapegoating, you can see how that leads to a degree of anger and divisiveness of a sort that we have right now. Inequality, in short, is very dangerous for our economy, and it's very dangerous for our society and our democracy. Inequality of the extent of the sort we are now experiencing. There are many things we can do, and I'll get into the solutions when I take your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert Reich, the former U.S. Secretary of Labor under President Clinton and the professor of public policy at Berkeley and the author of Aftershock, The New Economy, and America's Future. We have a large number of questions, many about the economy and some about politics, and I'll begin with the economy. In your book, Aftershock, you refer to a number of issues or solutions. Would you mind just elaborating on one or two of those that address inequality? Not the whole gamut of them, there are many, but one or two.
You know, last night I was on the Colbert Report. I do that occasionally. And Stephen Colbert said to me, what's your answer for widening inequality in 10 words or less? And I said, well, one thing we need to do is to, you know, raise revenues, particularly on the wealthy, and use it to improve our schools, preschool, after school. He said, stop, you're already way over 10. He said, try again. And I said, and I tried to shorten that message. And then he said, you only get 10 words. And I said, get big money out of politics. Easier said than done.
Okay. It's been 5 or 6 years now since Lehman Brothers failed and Wall Street had its considerable problems, but the big banks are back again and growing. What happened to Dodd-Frank, and would you reinstate Glass-Steagall if you could?
Would I reinstate Glass-Steagall? Undoubtedly, yes. And I think one of the biggest blots... one of the biggest blots on the Clinton administration is that it was the Clinton administration, it was in 1999, when the Clinton administration went along with Republicans in Congress and got rid of the Glass-Steagall Act. Now, the Glass-Steagall alone, if it were reinstated, will not prevent another too big to fail. We also, in my view, need to put a cap on the size of the biggest banks. That is necessary. There is support growing for that in Congress and in the Fed. If we don't do something about the fact that the big banks continue to get larger, at the same time that they are able to essentially gamble with their depositors' money. You know, the Volcker Rule, I look at your eyes and I start seeing eyes glazing over when I say the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule, for those of you who didn't follow this, the Volcker Rule was added to the Dodd-Frank Act as a kind of watered-down version of the Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall separated investment from a commercial banking. It was a Depression-era response to the Great Crash. Well, Paul Volcker wanted to come up with a compromise because the big banks didn't want Glass-Steagall back, and so there was a kind of watered-down version that he offered as a suggestion. But you know that the Volcker rule is still not in effect. Why is it not in effect? Because the big banks have so much political clout that they have prevented it from going into effect. They've delayed it. They've contested it. They've created loopholes. And Dodd-Frank, in many respects, is not yet in effect because the large banks have been so powerful. Where does their power come from? It comes from, number one, they provide a lot of money to both political parties. And number two, there is a revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. And I think that one way of getting big money out of politics is eliminating that revolving door and also putting real limits on the amount of money that corporations and also wealthy people can put into politics. But then we have something kind of an inconvenient truth of a Supreme Court case. So what do you do about Citizens United against the Federal Election Commission, which said that corporations are people? Well, you can only do one of two things. Number one, you can wait until one of the five members of the majority is no longer there on the court, and hope that the president who is there then will nominate, and Congress that is there then will approve of somebody who understands how our democracy really works. Alternatively, you can have a constitutional amendment that reverses Citizens United, that says corporations are not people. And by the way, while we're at it, money is not speech.
This questioner believes that in the past few decades, recessions have been growing deeper and taking longer to recover from. Is this the future of the American economy?
Well, I think that what we are seeing in the future, if nothing changes, we are going to see not necessarily deeper recessions, but I think we are going to see slow growth and a kind of a stagnation, an ongoing stagnation. We'll skate and skirt just above recessions. We will certainly have recessions. I don't think it's the depth of the recession that we have to worry about. It's the stagnation.
Okay. Corporations are now, as you've mentioned, sitting on record profits. Why aren't they creating jobs? The Republicans say it's because of the deficit and because of the uncertainties caused by the Obama administration. How would you respond to that?
I would say that's baloney. I overstated it. It's there's nothing to that argument. Because the major reason that businesses create jobs is when there is a demand for their goods and services. They create jobs when they have customers. They're not going to create jobs if they don't have customers. They're not going to expand if they don't have customers. This is not rocket science. Anybody in this room who runs a business or is a business executive knows exactly what I'm talking about. And the only way you get jobs, therefore, is if you have more money in more people's pockets. Now, that may seem like a very simple statement. It's not a simple statement. The question is, how do you enlarge the circle of prosperity? Those who say that the job creators are the people at the top are missing the major reality. The job creators are the customers. If the vast middle class and everybody aspiring to join the middle class, if they don't have enough money to be customers and to expand demand and enlarge demand for products and services, we're not going to have more jobs.
The CEOs of America's major corporations are by and large very bright, intellectual individuals. Don't the CEOs understand that? Don't they understand the policies that you're referring to?
Yes. Some of them do, and more of them are. Bill Gross, who heads PIMCO, largest bond fund, his newsletter, the most recent newsletter I saw, is an essay on the perils to the economy of inequality. I mean, he and I see almost exactly eye to eye on this. Others in American business, CEOs, are beginning to see exactly the same thing. Henry Ford, by the way, in 1914, paid his workers three times what the typical factory worker was earning, which earned the opprobrium of the Wall Street Journal, called him a traitor to his class. But he wasn't a traitor to his class. He was a cunning businessman. Henry Ford knew that he had a lot of influence in the auto industry. He knew that if he paid his workers three times what the typical worker was being paid, it would have a multiplier effect in terms of factory salaries throughout the system, throughout the economy, and that meant more people would be able to afford to buy Model T Fords. And the 2 years after he raised people's salaries, his own worker salaries, his own profits doubled. This is not a new idea, in other words.
Don't today's corporate policies often reduce the cost of consumer goods and increased standards of living. Would you generally support that? And more specifically, how would you feel about that policy referred to as Walmart's policy?
Walmart is one of my favorite companies to criticize. And I'll tell you why. Because Walmart, if you look at its employees, it's the number one employer in the United States. It is the biggest employer in America. So you would think the biggest employer in America would be a little bit of a trendsetter. It would understand the principle that we've been talking about. That if Walmart raised its salaries, it would have a multiplier effect. A lot of smaller businesses would have to raise theirs, too, in order to get the kind of people they wanted and needed. And that would increase demand, increase even Walmart's sales. For the last three quarters, Walmart's sales have been dropping. And the CEO of Walmart was quoted 2 days ago, 3 days ago in the New York Times as saying, well, he's not surprised sales have been dropping because Walmart customers have been squeezed by the economy. Hello? Earth to Walmart.
Scholars at the American Enterprise Institute have challenged your statistics. They have their own statistics finding that the poor and middle class have done better on a percentage basis than the rich have in the last few decades. How do you feel about that?
Who knows where they're getting their statistics from? There was one study that I believe the AEI, American Enterprise Institute, was relying on. There is a professor, who looked at the assets that the middle class had up to, and this is the important thing, ending the data series in the year 2007. And, of course, counting the assets as if it were liquid, that asset being obviously the value of homes. So if you count that and you kind of think of it as a liquid asset, something that can actually be traded in and it's in fact, people did use homes as piggy banks through those years in terms of refinancing. Well, you can create the impression that the middle class is doing very well, particularly if you end your data series in 2007. But let's not play games.
In your book, you refer to unions fairly often. What can unions do to make themselves more relevant as agents of change?
The sectors that are most rapidly growing in terms of employment are retail, restaurant, hotel, and hospital. Now, where you have large employers, large retailers, large restaurant chains, large hotel chains, large hospitals, that's where you have low-wage workers who tend not to be unionized. Well, if there was ever a logical argument for unionization in terms of providing more purchasing power for low-wage workers who don't have to compete with foreign workers, you're not competing with foreign workers in retail, restaurant, hotel, and hospital. You've got to actually provide the service here, unlike a lot of our industrial unions. Well, it would seem to me that that's where unions ought to focus their energies.
What impact did NAFTA have on the inequality that you've been discussing?
The North American Free Trade Act, which was put into effect in the Clinton administration, I think was oversold and overfeared. The big fear was that all the jobs would go to Mexico. Well, some of them went to Mexico, and then they went to China and Southeast Asia. The big hope by the Clinton administration was that NAFTA would boost the incomes and economic integration of all of North America, generating great, great prosperity. That did not happen. One effect of NAFTA, however, one very positive effect, was to help Mexico avoid the peso crisis, because there was more faith in the peso after NAFTA was negotiated. I have to be truthful with you. I was Secretary of Labor during that period. I was not a great fan of the North American Free Trade Act. I thought the labor and environmental standards in the act needed to be much stronger. And I would say generally, in terms of free trade is not bad. Free trade is good. But we do have to make sure when we enter into trade negotiations that labor and environmental standards are appropriate, that they don't lead to a race to the bottom. This doesn't mean that developing nations should be expected to have the same labor standards and environmental standards as rich countries. That would be a backdoor to protectionism. But we do, and we should expect, that as countries become richer through trade and through productivity, they can afford better and higher labor and environmental standards. That's what our aim ought to be and their aim ought to be.
Thank you. The New Deal created jobs and infrastructure that was tangible. What notable programs came out of the stimulus package that President Obama provided for us, and how would you have tweaked it if you had had the opportunity to do so?
Well, the stimulus program that the Obama administration initiated, as you remember, many of you remember, this is not ancient history, in order to get it past Congress, at least half of it had to be in tax breaks. Well, tax breaks are a very inefficient way of actually stimulating, because when people are worried about their incomes and worried that they're not going to have much money, if they have a tax break, they're going to save. They're not going to spend. So what you want government to do is actually spend. Spending, particularly on infrastructure projects, can be very efficient, very effective. And we didn't do it. We didn't do nearly enough. I'll take some of the blame. I testified before Congress in January of 2009, and members of Congress wanted to know how big the stimulus package should be. Nobody knew at that time how bad things were and how deep the recession was going to be. And I was on a panel with two other policy analysts, economists, one who was a Republican advisor, one who was Marty Feldstein, a previous Republican advisor. I was the token Democrat. And Marty Feldstein started, and they said to him, Professor Feldstein, how big should the stimulus be? And he said, oh, about $800 billion. And I turned to the fellow next to me, who was another Republican advisor, and I whispered. I said, how did Marty get that number? And he said to me, I have no idea. And then they asked him, how big should the stimulus be? And he said, $800 billion. And then it came to my turn, and it was obvious. It was $800 billion. And that's, again, the stimulus was, in my view, in hindsight, it's easy to say. It was much too small and not enough direct spending.
This is a combination of questions. The greatest emphasis of discussion that we see regarding the economy refers to the middle class. We don't hear very much about the poor anymore. What can be done to, and when there are references, for example, the cutting of food stamps, what can be done to try to raise the heightened awareness of what's happening to the poor in this nation today?
Well, what's happening to the poor is also happening to a lot of the middle class. The divide that we used to assume when Michael Harrington wrote The Other America in 1962, that the poor really were a different set of people, not like us, and they were invisible. Actually, what's happening now is that many people who assume they are middle class discover after a serious illness or a major layoff that they are poor. The boundary is porous. And that is very important politically. Because for years, you see, it was possible for the middle class to say, the poor are different from you and me. And therefore, we don't really need and shouldn't have social safety nets that are nearly as generous as what the poor actually need. But once people understand there but for the grace of God go I and my family, there is the potential for a political coalition between the middle class and the poor, because everybody really is in the same boat. So back to the question, when there is discussion about the middle class, I think it's also important to implicitly understand or explicitly state, as I have tried tonight, to include everybody who aspires to join the middle class, and also to be aware of the dynamic that I mentioned to you in terms of anybody falling.
The Cato Institute has a study that points out that there are 126 federal programs to help people in need. Hence, the poor have a great deal of support from the federal government, and hence lack motivation to find jobs, etc. How would you respond to that?
Well, I don't have much of a temper. But when I hear people say that the reason that we have so many people unemployed is because there is too much unemployment insurance or disability insurance or too much food stamps, it gets my blood boiling, because I know that's not true. There are still three people looking for work for every job that is available, job opening. And in most states, unemployment insurance pays only a fraction of what people had before they were unemployed. And 40% of Americans who are unemployed don't even have eligibility for unemployment insurance. And beyond that, we know that extended emergency unemployment helps the economy overall, for all of the reasons I've talked to you tonight about. It means more money in the pockets of more people who can then turn around and buy stuff. If Congress does not act in the next 2 weeks to extend emergency unemployment insurance, 1.3 million Americans will suddenly be cut off of unemployment insurance at the end of December, the beginning of January. If they do nothing in early January, another 850,000 Americans lose their unemployment insurance. This is not just a human tragedy in the making. This is also an economic tragedy, because it means that you've got over 2 million people who will not be able to be participating in the economy and generating the kind of demand we need, which is going to result in more unemployment, folks. Have I cheered you up tonight, by the way? No, this is outrageous.
Well, let's talk about that. Will I cheer you up part a little bit? Have we gotten to the point where things are becoming hopeless for us? Have we reached a tipping point where the income inequality has become so great that it's going to stop our democracy from functioning? How close are we to that tipping point?
Well, I think if you think of a tipping point as the point at which income inequality starts fundamentally altering and injuring your economy and undermining your democracy, then an argument can be made that we are already there. If you think of a tipping point as the point at which people realize that and start mobilizing and energizing and becoming politically active to turn it around, as Americans did beginning in 1901 in the Progressive Era, when we saw a very similar situation in terms of widening inequality and corruption, or as we did in the 1930s when everybody was in the same boat, or as we did in the 1960s when we had quite a lot of prosperity, but there were parts of America that were excluded from that prosperity. And so we determined, through a Voting Rights Act, and before that a Civil Rights Act, and then after that Medicare and Medicaid in terms of the elderly poor, that we would expand prosperity. We do it. We do it over and over again. What gives me hope, not only hope, but utter confidence, is that we are approaching that kind of tipping point again. As Winston Churchill once said, I love to quote Winston Churchill, Americans always do the right thing eventually, after they exhaust every other alternative.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Robert Reich, the noted economist and former Labor Secretary under President Bill Clinton, who is discussing this evening economic inequality in America. You can also find a video of the Commonwealth Club programs online at 4.tv. Let's switch to political aspects right now. The current wisdom points to the fact that Hillary Clinton is the lead for the presidential nomination in 2016. However, there's been a new wave of discussion about Elizabeth Warren and her positions on the economy. How do you feel about her positions on the economy? There was only one question about her here. I didn't know her club was here this evening, but
I'm put in a little bit of an awkward position because I've known Hillary Rodham Clinton since before she was Hillary Clinton.
In fact,
I introduced her to her husband. Okay, I'll tell you even one other thing. When she was an undergraduate, Hillary Rodham at Wellesley College, we went on a date. I didn't remember much about that date, but in the election of 2008, I got a call from a reporter from the New York Times who said that he had come across a collection of letters from Hillary during her years at Wellesley, and she mentioned going out on a date with me. And he asked, can I remember anything about that date that might shed light on how she would perform as president?
And you said?
I thought obviously he was kidding, and I, with my tongue firmly planted in my cheek, I said, well, we went to a movie and she wanted an inordinate amount of butter on her popcorn. And then I heard nothing. I said, excuse me, are you still there? I thought maybe he had hung up. He said, no, I'm just writing this down. Now, Elizabeth Warren comes from my home state. I know her very well. I worked very hard to get her elected. I have nothing but admiration for her. She is a good friend. And that's where I will end my commentary.
Has the two-party system in the United States become dysfunctional? Is it not time to have a really strong third political party? You make reference to one in your book in a rather negative way. But is it time for a third party in this country?
Well, in some sense, it's always time for a third party. But in another sense, it's very hard to get a third party going in a winner-take-all system. Some of us may remember what happened in 2000 when Ralph Nader tried, and there are still people around who won't forgive Ralph Nader. Because, you see, the third party tends to draw votes away from the party that's closest ideologically to that third party, thereby giving the election to the opposite extreme. Now, the only factor, it seems to me, that might lead to a third party in America over the next, give it three election cycles, is that you have in the Republican Party right now a civil war. It is serious. It is a serious civil war. The Tea Partiers and the establishment Republicans are going at it. I don't know how that's going to end, but I can tell you that there is an interesting and subtle parallel in the Democratic Party in just the following way, and I don't want to overstate this because I don't want to get into the sin of false equivalence. But one aspect of the Tea Party movement is its deep suspicion of the establishment in terms of collusion between Wall Street and big business and government against the rest of us. That's only one aspect. Now, obviously, the Tea Party has directed its wrath against government, and a lot of the financing of the Tea Party has come from the likes of the Koch brothers and others who have a vested interest in reducing the size and scope of government regulation. But nevertheless, there is this kind of anti-establishment thrust. The Tea Party came out of the bailout of Wall Street, and so did the Occupy movement. So that what intrigues me is that there is the potential, I'm not saying this is good or bad, in the United States for a third party that is a populist anti-establishment party, trust in our major institutions, Congress, politics generally, corporations, big business, Wall Street, trust in our major institutions has never been lower in the modern era. And given that, and given that kind of attraction of people who are so angry, as I said before, anger could potentially generate a populist movement of both the left and the right, anti-establishment. Whether it is reform-minded or not, we can't know. Populism can take ugly forms. It can take very positive forms.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. Bill O'Reilly referred to you as a communist on his television program. Is it true you've challenged him to a duel in the same grounds that Hamilton and Burr had their last duel?
No, I would like to think that I was that courageous, but I do think that it is important if you have millions of viewers or listeners, and if you are going to disagree with somebody and call them names, it seems to me incumbent on somebody like that to be willing to debate what it is they disagree with. And so when Bill O'Reilly called me a communist, and he's done it again since, I simply said publicly, I said, well, why, you know, Bill O'Reilly, have me on your show? Or if you don't want to have me on your show, name a place and a time anywhere in the continental United States, and I will be there, and we will debate, and I will whip you.
Our thanks to Robert Reich, the former United States Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy in Berkeley, and the author of the newly updated book, Aftershock. That book is, of course, the basis of the documentary, Inequality for All. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio and television and the Internet. I want to remind our audience that Secretary Reich has been very, very gracious to stay and meet with some of you and sign some books after this program. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned. Thank you.